top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 340 of the Really Awful Movies podcast, Urban Legend. Woe the success of Scream and that franchise. I mean, the original Scream, Wes Craven's postmodern flick, that one may have revitalized horror at the box office as it was kind of sagging as a property. It also did inspire a slew of rather watered down, ineffectual, and inferior imitators, which didn't have the an ounce of the spark that made the original Scream so compelling. I mean, just killing off Drew Barrymore alone in the first scene made it pretty impressive to many at the time. Now, après Scream, it seemed not a week at the multiplex went by without another kind of a weak and tepid, toothless horror film foisted on the public, featuring really, you know, telegenic, hyper self-aware people. And 1998 brought us Urban Legend, and it's a main offender when it comes to this kind of casting. It features Jared Leto, who, you know, a very fine actor who from Dallas Buyers Club, and recently I saw him in the reboot of Blade Runner, which I'm still trying to get my head around. He was actually really good in that, in a bit of a scene-stealing turn. Urban Legend also features the guy from Dawson's Creek, who's not Dawson. It's actually Joshua Jackson, the Canadian actor, who was his friend, I guess. And there's Tara Reid appears in this thing as well as one of those college radio hosts. I think she hosts some kind of relationship show in Urban Legend. But basically anyone who is anyone at the time is in this one. However, Urban Legend is a film that really is so bad that, speaking of, you know, notable people in the movie, cast member Robert Englund, who plays a professor, Professor Wexler, who's an expert in Urban Legend storytelling a la Jan Brunvald, who rose to success with a series of books on the topic. But in his book, Hollywood Monster, the Freddy Krueger actor doesn't even mention this. I mean, it's possible that the guy works like has a work rate that'll rival maybe Vincent Price, but you'd think at least in some point, this film, as it was quite a popular one, would come up. But nothing, not a chapter, not a remark, not an aside, not an image, nothing. So, I mean, it could be, I don't know why that would be the case, but for someone who went to school at the University of Toronto, this one really piqued my interest as it features so many of the school's locations. But how I came to this one and revisiting it is a very, very minor imbroglio and brouhaha on Twitter that I don't even think Jared Leto really took notice of. But earlier this week, I saw that someone I was following on Twitter who had worked on the Urban Legend production took umbrage with the fact that Mr. Leto had refused to acknowledge that he'd even appeared in the 1998 vehicle, which the guy said, I believe in his tweet, that at the time when Leto's star was on the ascent, that he was really appreciative of working in it and would watch the dailies and would try and improve his performance. Now, in the film, Jared Leto plays a J-school Woodward and Bernstein type, and that's actually a dismissive remark one of the characters later makes about him. But he plays a journalist who's trying to get to the bottom of a bunch of strange occurrences at the fictional Pendleton University in New Hampshire, substituted in beautifully by my alma mater, one of the world's great universities in the top 25 anyway, according to the rankings, the University of Toronto. So it's funny, like Leto is completely disavowed this production. I always think the word disavowed, I always think the ex-POTUS and disavowing certain things that happened in the Carolinas and whatnot. But it's weird because when you look at the likes of Johnny Depp and Jennifer Aniston and Kevin Bacon, all these stars who came to fame later on after appearing in these throwaway productions, they're really nothing to be ashamed about. And it's something you can really celebrate in a way. But anyway, I was thinking about this as there's a confluence of three factors that really spurred my interest in the film Urban Legend and revisiting it. One being that I'm a journalist myself, and even though it's funny, I didn't even work on my campus paper, but I'm a trade journalist now covering business news, but also I have a keen interest in seeing my alma mater appear on screen. And Toronto actually, as an aside, has been the backdrop to not only a bunch of very good Cronenberg movies, and I think Edward Norton has filmed a few pretty good movies up here, but also some real duds. I'm thinking of Things, which has got to be one of the worst horror films ever made, and that was filmed in Scarborough, which is a misbegotten, sort of somewhat wretched borough of the city of Toronto in the East End. It was described on IMDb as a husband whose fanatical desire but inability to father children drives him to force his wife to undergo a dangerous experiment, which sounds terrific, but believe me, it's not. And other just craptacular Big Smoke TO lensed efforts, or maybe not efforts if they put little effort into it, was Nurse 3D, yes, starring model and actress Paz de la Huerta. This thing is just, I mean, craptacular, but makes really good use of the city's most iconic hotel property, which is the Fairmont Royal York, but also a bunch of, I think where the Toronto Symphony plays, a bunch of other stuff. I guess Saw 5, there was, I recognize some of that location, which is when I used to work at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, so they have a lot of stuff from that, and it is a sputtering effort from a series that I hold in beneath contempt anyway, because I think it occupies that sort of torturous porn space that I find rather unpalatable and rather obnoxious, and it's a that was done around like the same region. It's weird to think that this as well, or a rather lengthy aside, that something so trashy could be filmed adjacent to something so elevating, the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, which, you know, highlights the works of Mendelssohn and Brahms and Bach, and then you have this just pure dreck and Jigsaw and Saw and all this. Just the nadir of horror, I think, was in the early 2000s, and there's no better exemplification than the likes of Hostel and the Eli Roth efforts from that period. But Jason X, as an aside, was also filmed there too. So yeah, it's just funny. So you have these three things coming together inexplicably, and you have your Leto, who's some of whose work I've seen. I quite liked him in My So-Called Life, a TV show with Claire Danes that came out in the 90s as well. But you have Leto, a journalist, and Toronto, and my alma mater front and center. And what you have is this fictional university, and Professor Wexler, is played by Robert Englund, teaches this course, and it details all these accounts of these urban legends. And I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before that I've been curious about why people throw sneakers and kicks and tie the laces together and hurl them up on power lines. And I actually reached out to Jan Harald Brunvand, the professor at Utah University, to actually inquire about why this is the case, when I passed along erroneously to a cab driver that this is actually gang members marking their territory. So I actually told a cab driver that, only to realize dope, I'm an idiot, it has nothing to do with that. And I was corrected by Professor Brunwand, who also said, and he was quite polite about it, but he said he had to go back to his skiing trip, and he's I think since retired and living a life of quiet solitude in the mountains, and good on him. But I should mention another thing regarding the professor's books, and that they were sent to me when I was working on my first book as an inspiration for something in the mass market nonfiction world to bring up to my then publisher, Penguin Books. So I leafed through a box of books that the publisher sent me, including Brunmann's book. And I would say a lot of the famous urban legends from his book that he brought to popular attention feature prominently in the 1998 film Urban Legend. And you have stuff like the gang ritual, which is apparently where you drive around in pitch dark, and then when someone tells you to your lights are off by flicking their high beams at you, you murder them if you're a gang member, a Blood or a Crip or God knows one of these gangs. So that one features prominently. Of course, the AIDS one on the mirror is the most horrifying urban legend, but that doesn't feature here. That would have brought this to a whole new level. But there's also the kidney urban legend, which is quite a good one, in which two people meet in a bar, and one member of the party wakes up in a daze that they've been maybe chloroformed or roofied or something, and they wake up in a bathtub full of ice, and they have a scar, and apparently one of their organs has been removed, which I always think is very very bizarre, because how could you get a surgeon who can capably perform such a complex 6 to 10 hour surgical procedure and do it in some crappy flats bathroom. But I digress. So you have a bunch of different people at this Pendleton University, and you have a legend about the infamous person hiding in the back seat. So you have the axe murderer, you have the man with the hook for a hand, you have the legend of the gas station attendant with a stutter who can't warn the driver that there's someone hiding in the back seat. So, I mean, Leto, as the plucky journalist investigating the happenings, is pretty weird, and I did, again, get a really, really good kick out of University of Toronto in its neo-Gothic 200-year-old architecture featuring so prominently here. It's a star in its own right, and it's a bit of a family tradition for folks in my family, my mom, bunch of cousins, to go to the University of Toronto. And there's a coffee shop that I used to frequent called Diabolo's, and it's still there, and it's featured prominently here, and it's got a bit of a Hogwarts vibe with dark wood, and you have some kind of famous names that are etched into the panels, and it's a popular student hangout. And I really got a kick out of the Rotman School of Management, where really rich people, I guess, further themselves and other rich people by earning MBA degrees. And there's a pivotal scene where I believe Tara Reid's talk radio, a campus radio character, meets her demise as she hangs off a ledge in that faculty building. And there's just so many little spots that I recognize, and Victoria College, and Torontonians will get a kick out of the pivotal pool scene that's filmed out where our late and not so great mayor hails from in the west end of the city. That would be Rob Ford, who for better or for worse put the city on the map with his Jamaican patois and his crack smoking. So larger than life figure, for again better or for worse. Now, I guess it's going to be a shorter than usual podcast here, as I'm going to segue into what I learned, because there's so many, many things that you can... I mean, with my co-author and co-host Jeff, I was exchanging messages today and thinking about tweeting to get some engagement with people about what they think are the worst and maybe best decades of all time in horror, and the 90s would be way, way, way down on my list. And again, a lot of that you can lay at the foot of Scream. and Wes Craven, because you have all these self-referential, winking, and I think, frankly, disrespectful takes on the horror genre. And instead of aiming for fears, you get this kind of detachment and mocking tone that really did it a disservice for years to come. And it was only until, I guess, later in the 2010s that we experienced quite a bit of a genre, I think, resurgence, and a mini golden era, while not one to match the 80s or 70s, was worthy in its own right. And 2007 and 2015 were really, really stellar years in the horror genre, but the 90s was a rough time, and not the worst, which again I alluded to earlier, which would be the early 2000s, but it was pretty grim. And one aspect of this, while we're on the subject of what I learned, Dawson's Creek star Joshua Jackson, there's a scene in it where he's trying to put the make on one of the main characters, and they're listening to the radio, and as this is infused with urban legend stuff, of course you have to have a make-out point, and the two paramours trying to get hot and heavy. Now, what song should come on the radio? I don't want to wait for love to be over, whatever that was from Dawson's Creek, and the Joshua Jackson character hurriedly rushes to the dial to turn it off, and it's one of these just egregious yucks that really sends things south and sours me on this one. Despite, it should be said, I think a really whiz-bang premise and really dynamite cast. So it's pretty funny what they could have done with this movie, with, I think, tapping into a premise that's, I think, a lot more interesting than typical fare that's set around a college campus, whether that would be the likes of the trauma film Splatter University, or one of our really awful movie site favorites, Final Exam, which is bloody hilarious. But I mean, college co-eds, you put them on a college campus, you have them plucked off one by one. When you see something like that, and you see a twist, and you see some kind of narrative thrust that has something just different from the typical masked intruder hanging about in the shadows, it's something you really appreciate. And I think something like Happy Death Day is a wonderful example of setting a film on a college campus, but doing something really, really unique with it. And so you don't just have a bunch of telegenic co-eds just dying in sequence. So kudos on that property. I should say that while the antagonist was pretty crappy, it's not really a spoiler to say that it's someone in a mask who is co-opting the varsity team colors and mascot as a disguise. But it's a film that is decent in its own right. The original and the sequel is actually pretty good too, and it's actually way smarter than it has any right to be. So what could have happened in the case of Urban Legend was that they could have tapped into this cultural zeitgeist moment and really explored tapping into the stuff like Brun Vaughn's Encyclopedia of Urban Legends. Apologies, I'm just looking over to my bookshelf here, but there, lots of legends are brought up. And another thing I've learned was there's a music legend that is brought up as well, and it's involving the recording of Love Roller Coaster, which is a dynamite funk song from, I believe, the maybe the later half of the 70s by the funk outfit The Ohio Players. It's possible the Red Hot Chili Peppers covered it, but your love is like a roller coaster, baby, and it's just killer. And apparently on that track there were allegedly screams of someone getting shot in the studio, but that's been since subsequently debunked. But it was pretty cool to have that inclusion in Urban Legend. And really, I mean, this could have really gone somewhere different, because you had all the hallmarks and all the makings of something that could have been really, really timeless. And unfortunately, it really sputtered out of control toward the end, although it did have some kind of memorable set pieces. And I gotta say, we just watched Edge of the Axe, and I was thinking about like maybe Silent Night, Bloody Night, and just all the, it's just the glut and the surfeit of axe murderer movies. But I neglected to put Urban Legend in that category, because yes, there's someone wielding an axe in that, and the quintessential maniac on the loose is no doubt going to use that as a horror movie weaponry. Shout out to our book, Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, with a foreword by Lloyd Kaufman that we penned a few years ago. But another thing I've learned is that in this movie there's an appearance by a City TV news anchor, and City TV was the the TV channel that ran a sort of a transgressive fare that inspired Videodrome and David Cronenberg for his Civic TV. So this is City TV, and then senior anchor Gord Martineau, who many of us will recognize in Toronto, he makes a very, very small appearance in this, and it's kind of a role I guess you'd be born to play if you're a TV journalist. A news anchor. So there you go. That was pretty cool to see, but this movie brought up a lot of memories, not the least of which was the lost and misguided soul that yours truly, Christopher, was, I guess, at the time, and trying to find his footing in a university and really almost put on academic probation and just not, you know, handling the difficulties present in life sciences after switching out from general arts. And University of Toronto is a notoriously competitive, hyper-competitive school that was put on the map by developing the first pacemaker and for the school's involvement in the discovery of insulin and curing diabetes effectively back in the day 100 years ago. But it, like, the brightest minds from around the world flocked to this school, and boy, I was out of my element and struggling and spending a lot of time just trying to fill out degree requirements for my life sciences degree and struggling with neuroscience and zoology and just basically getting by the skin of my teeth and my ability to write. And that was really it, putting me through school at the time. And it was really a very... very difficult place to get ahead and to make friends, because it's just so cutthroat and such a big school, and there's so many other things to do in downtown Toronto that there's really no varsity life to speak of whatsoever. The sports matches are poorly attended, and there's really very little campus life at all. But there's still a few good memories I have, as it's the school subdivided into individual colleges, and my college happened, this is like the UK system in a way, and with Oxford and Cambridge and whatnot, but my college happened to be the seat of the school's film department, and I have fond memories of watching The Changeling and the Free Friday film screenings, which continue to this day at Innes College, which is has the lowest academic entry standards, I think it's fair to say, of any of the University of Toronto colleges. So urban legend was interesting to revisit and to see all these, at the time, fresh faces, and to see Robert Englund, who's been in, is, to be fair, just a boatload of just super cheesy movies, despite being a pretty decent stage actor, but his brilliance is not really showcased in anything but the likes of A Nightmare on Elm Street, and many of his horror efforts are just really bottom-of-the-barrel stuff. I think that's it in terms of what I learned, but the only way you can really put Scream into context is to compare it with some of its what came out in the aftermath of that era. So it really does hold up very well. I think some of its sequels possibly too, but what happened later in the 90s and then what spawned the torture porn era was just a really dark place for horror. And it's nice to see that with Jordan Peele and Us and Get Out and Mike Flanagan and all these new filmmakers just breathing life into the genre. It's really such a great space to be in now, and given that film's prominence is not where it used to be, you can still make money just like you did in the 70s in the exploitation tax shelter era. You can make money reliably with horror properties, especially with everyone in lockdown and people looking for scares. And it's something I've been doing. I've been watching an inordinate amount of horror movies lately, and I'm set up to get my first jab in the arm, get my first, I don't know which vaccine, whether it's AstraZeneca or Pfizer, but anyway, star rating for Urban Legend. Again, if you take the first 30 minutes, things, you know, go on along at a nice, really nice clip, and there's some nice banter, and toward the end, it just dissolves into just pure silliness, and they do keep you guessing as to who the killer could be. There's a nice little twist denouement, but I don't think the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and I think it does, to be charitable, you could say it's a 3, but I'm going to give it probably a 2.5 out of 5, and I think it's nostalgia that's really informing my fondness for the film, revisiting it so many years hence. But It's just so just weird to see these the doors that I graced so many a time as I was in a very, very different period in my life, and reading all these neuroscience studies and learning all about the brain and neurotransmitters and all this stuff. It was just, I feel like I'm in such a different headspace now, but I'm grateful to the education that the school afforded me, and I'm proud to be an alum, that's for sure. And seeing my alma mater in film has just warmed my heart to a certain extent, so maybe 2¾ for this one. Going to be coming back shortly with joint effort once Jeff feels up to it, and really looking forward to chatting about all things genre cinema, but predominantly horror and action. And I shall talk to you soon. Take care.